On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're lucky, you remember the first time you stuck your head into the briny sea with a snorkel and mask or just open eyes. Or when you first saw famed explorer and diving pioneer Jacques Cousteau on the Calypso, introducing TV viewers to the wonders of the life aquatic.
Now we can observe that the wise dolphin never swims straight ahead of the boat, but cautiously leans from side to side, ready to drop off if threatened. From the observation port, the animals are identified as the saddleback dolphin, one of 50 dolphin species belonging to the whale family.
Marine biologist Trevor Norton has spent a lifetime on the water and underwater with sea creatures, coral reefs, and kelp. Now he's looking back and out on the ocean's majesty and its vulnerability. This hour on Point, a personal memoir and natural history of the sea and its fate with the celebrated marine biologist Trevor Norton. You can join the conversation. Give us your great tales from the sea, from the underwater universe. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Douglas on the Isle of Man, northwest of Liverpool, is Trevor Norton. He's professor of marine biology at the University of Liverpool and director of the Port Erin Marine Laboratory. He's been diving for 50 years. Since he was 15 years old, he's author of the new collection of essays, Underwater to Get Out of the Rain, A Love Affair with the Sea. Trevor Norton, thank you so much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
Wow, a long career and so much of it in the sea. You grew up with that sea right in your face, but it wasn't always enchanting until you got underneath.
No. The east coast of Britain's got a rather sullen sea there. The North Sea is not the place you go diving usually. It's cold and it's uninviting. But it was the first place I went in, with goggles and a toasting fork attached to a bamboo cane. And from the first moment, I was absolutely enchanted. I felt this was the real world, and why I'd have been wasting my time up there on land before. The sea looked as if it had been waiting for me. It was fabulous. And as you said in your introduction, when I was down there, a bird just plummeted into the water straight in front of me. And I thought this, I'd never seen anything like that before.
The cormorant diving for a lunch or breakfast, missed it as it turned out, but you saw it coming down like a spear into the ocean.
Yep, just like a javelin in a cone of bubbles. Absolutely magic.
Place us, your sort of very big span of going undersea and along coasts for the last 50 years, place it in the history of human interaction with the sea, if you will. I mean, this is not exactly back in the old Greek diving bell period. This is when new technology began to make the sea more accessible, and television and movies began to show that. You had your own Hans Haas, the hero of undersea exploration. When did you come on the scene?
Well, it was this, when I was 15, that was 1955. And at school, I was not exactly the learned academic. My reports tell the story. By the time he learns to speak French, he'll be too old to cross the channel. And when I came bottom in one subject, it said, much improved work this term. And then I saw Hans Haas on TV in a wonderful set of programs called Diving to Adventure. And he was just a handsome Austrian, you know, marine biologist. And he had this gorgeous wife called Lottie.
Oh.
sorry, I'm just reminiscing. And he used to stand, you know, sit her on a boss of coral with sharks circling, and she looked good enough to eat. And I knew from then I'm going to be a marine biologist and a handsome Austrian when I grow up. And luckily, this is radio, so you don't see how much I failed in one of those.
But you don't sound very Austrian. You began with that bamboo with a fork tied to it and snorkel and mask. But what about
I was ready for anything.
Well, what about the technology that allowed you and Hans Haas and Jacques Cousteau and everyone to go underneath? Were we in the full swing of the scuba era by the time you took to the sea?
No, it was just beginning. There was very few people diving. I think in about 1955, there was the real selling of the aqualung has started, but it mostly started in the United States. 80% of all the aqualungs sold in 1955 were sold in California. I think that was where they thought there was going to be a big market, and they were right. So in Europe, there wasn't so much. And Hans Haas, he didn't use an aqualung in the early days. He used those oxygen rebreathers where you just breathe oxygen and keep on scrubbing it and getting rid of the carbon dioxide.
Yeah, yeah.
The things that frogmen used to use.
Right.
Very dangerous.
I wish you'd give us a little reading. This book is a wonderful kind of combination of a memoir and marine biology lesson. It's also the lesson of an explorer. There's a bit on page 103 where you talk about, and your career has taken you all over the planet on the watery side, about the sort of timing issues in exploration and what remains. I wish you'd read some of that for us.
Okay, I'll do it in spite of my sore throat.
Good.
Here we go. In exploration, timing is everything. Yesterday's expedition is today's excursion and tomorrow's package tour. The word remote has lost its meaning. An adventurous sort in ever more pointless stunts. The daring bustle to be first to balloon around the world backwards or cycle across Antarctica. And we celebrate their achievement, for we're too polite to say, haven't you got anything better to do? Even the explorers are unsure why they went, and the old excuse, because it's there, is perhaps the best answer to be expected from brains starved of oxygen from too much bivouacking at high altitude. There are only two great wildernesses left, outer space and the deep ocean. Space is a dusty void full of the wreckage of defunct satellites. Rockets have to dodge their way past, en route to Jupiter. We justify the expense of escaping from gravity by claiming we are heading for the stars. But in truth, we are only peering at lifeless planets. Only 1% of the ocean has been explored, and its dark floor twinkles with just as many stars as in the heavens. But these are luminescent winks of unknown creatures of wondrous design and mysterious behavior. You can keep the dead expanse above our heads. Given a choice of which stars to explore, I would go down to the living illuminations beneath the sea. Who knows what aliens await discovery?
Marine biologist Trevor Norton reading from his new book, Underwater to Get Out of the Rain, A Love Affair with the Sea. There's a kind of irony here that you describe this tremendous, largely unexplored, I guess terrain's not exactly the right word, but region.
Yeah, terrain's fine.
Terrain,
yeah.
Does it work? Okay.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're already told that the seas are threatened, that the impact of human everything may be overwhelming. Help us understand both the sort of mystery of the scale of unexplored region and the threat that we can have even before we've seen what's there.
Well, it's been said that we know more about the surfacing surface of the moon than we knew about the deep ocean, and I think that's right. And it's astonishing because the ocean is the biggest living space on the planet. It's 7/10 covering the surface of the Earth. It's an average depth of 2.5 miles. If you put Everest in the deepest bit, it would vanish without a trace. Only really tall mountains like Hawaii poke above the surface. Poor old modest Hawaii doesn't boast about being the tallest mountain in the world, but it should.
Right.
You know, and so much of what we've learned about the sea, we've learned very, very recently. In the sea, down the center of each of the big oceans, like the Atlantic and the Pacific and the others, there's a range of mountains, a great ridge. This chain all joins up. It's 44,000 miles long. It covers a quarter of the entire surface of the Earth. And until the 1950s, we did not know it existed. Now, one of the reasons is we take lots of samples, but they're tiny. When I was a kid, when you used to go to the movie house, outside there were about 10 or 12 so publicity shots from the picture, just still photographs. Now, try and imagine sorting out the plot of the film by just looking at those 12 photographs. That's the problem in the deep sea. And it's so unknown that if I dropped you down now a mile beneath the surface and you picked up the first animal you came to and brought it back to me, the chances are 50-50 that it would be an entirely new species never seen by anyone till that time. In a recent survey in the 90s, off the eastern seaboard of the United States, that one survey discovered 800 new species not known to science. Quite extraordinary. That's the degree with which we don't know the deep ocean.
Are we going to know the deep ocean before we destroy it?
Well, it's a big thing to know. And we're learning all the time. I mean, we're getting lots of new discoveries. We thought at one time that all the energy that went into the deep ocean must come from the sun. It must drop down from above, and it does. Once the plankton blooms on the surface, you know, that's the productivity of all these small things which the fish and everything eat. It takes about a month for that to drop to the bottom. And you can see it. It suddenly appears like a sort of fluff on the bottom, about 2 feet deep. And within 6 months, it's all gobbled up. It's a sort of orgy of feeding just for 6 weeks. And we thought that was the only food that these things could get. Then, of course, we found these black smokers, these things, these chimneys producing very rich mineral soup in the bottom of the sea and having a very special fauna around them. But although we're learning a lot, it's an expensive and a laborious thing to do. It's not easy to explore the bottom of the sea or even the huge volume of water in which all the other organisms live. So even with the sort of money that goes into it, it's trivial in comparison with the money that's spent on many other things. So it will be slow, and you could well, like we keep saying with the, you know, the Amazonian jungles, we could destroy the habitat before we've actually found out what it contains.
Trevor Norton, I want to just get out of your way a little bit and let you tell us some stories of great undersea moments in the many decades you've spent there. Give us some high points of insights into undersea life and terrain, if you would.
Well, where to start? I think some of my highlights have actually been diving in the United States. Certainly when I was in California, one of the most wonderful things I saw was the giant kelp forest. That's something you must treasure, because these giant kelp plants, you know, 100 feet tall, are just a wonderful forest.
Kelp is a passion of yours, and I have to admit, I've never dived in a kelp forest. I had no sense of it. In your description, it sounds like mightier than an oak forest.
Oh, it is. And it's, well, it doesn't have to have these great big heavy trunks to keep the thing upright. All they have is each sort of leaf on the kelp has a little bladder full of gas, and it suspends the whole thing, so it doesn't need to be sturdy. It's got sort of thin trunks. And I once dived under a boulder that was about a yard and a half across, and it was suspended above the bottom of the sea. I could dive underneath because it had a kelp keeping it buoyant on top. And it being slim and having thousands of leaves, which are rather large, it just sways elegantly in the current in a seductive way, absolutely beautiful.
What's the marine life in the kelp forest off the California coast?
Oh, it's hooching. Darwin of the on the Beagle, when he first saw the giant kelp forest, said if any forest on land were destroyed, not nearly so many creatures would perish as would here if at the destruction of the kelp. And certainly when someone examined a small stand of kelp in California, he found 67,000 different animals in it.
Wow.
You know, really an incredible variety. And there's lots of wonderful things.
We'll come back to California. You've got some great stories there, but you've been right around. I mean, I've snorkeled in the Pacific and Caribbean, swam with seals off the Cairn of Cull off Scotland, where you've done lots of work in that area. You recount one time when you found yourself swimming into the midst of some, was it bull seals or sea lions who weren't so happy to see you?
Oh, that was in California.
Was it California also?
Yes,
sorry,
that was
California. Lost track.
Yeah, no. It was off the Channel Islands in California, and there's a huge cave there, I think called the Painted Cave. And you could easily hide a cathedral inside, and it's pitch black because it turns at right angles. And I was just swimming in, and I suddenly realized I wasn't alone. No one had told me that hundreds of sea lions come there to mate. And suddenly the water was full of rutting sea lions, presumably assuming I was a rival male, or possibly a seductive female, which would be even worse. And all they did was to buzz me and try to intimidate me, and they succeeded. I got out pretty quick.
You spent a lot of time in cold waters, not just the kind of paradises that the Jacques Cousteau movies tended to show us. We think of tropical blue, but there's a lot of dark and cold work here as well.
Yes, there is, but many of the waters I spent about 10 years in the Isles of Scotland, as you said, and the diving there was wonderful, and the place is wonderful. I mean, the reason the book's called Underwater, the Get Out of the Rain is because of those 10 years. The beautiful Hebridean Islands of Scotland face the Atlantic, so they get all this reject weather from the United States. And it's very changed. I'm going to speak to the president when he's got some time. It's not on. But the islands are beautiful. And it wouldn't matter if you didn't go diving just to see the islands. And each one is very distinctive. And they each have this distinctive fauna and flora underwater. I remember diving in a slate quarry, which was a very small island, and the slate quarry had been mined and mined. The walls got thinner and thinner, and one day the sea broke through, and it was, I don't know, about 100 feet deep and about sort of 400 or 500 yards across. And it was just like going into an enormous chimney. And it was absolutely full of life. And also, of course, full of death, all the sort of dead remnants of the equipment the men had used about a century before. Mm. It was but very creepy place to dive. With diving, you don't get worried when you're being tossed around by the waves. What you worry about is when you're in the calm somewhere. It's unnaturally calm is unnerving. I once dived, in fact, hundreds of times, I dived in a beautiful sea loch in West Cork called Loch Hyne. Mm. And in one part, it's about, I guess it's about sort of 100 and odd feet. Mommy's more. Maybe it's about, 100 feet, mm-hmm. 350 feet deep at one end. And it's full of about several hundred feet of silt. And when you go down, I went down so quickly, I vanished completely inside the bottom.
Into
so
the silt, the loose silt.
Into the silt. Oh, and I had no idea which way was out. So I just felt which way my air was going. And I said, that must be up. But it's incredible.
Vertigo on the sea bottom.
That's
the
right.
Bottom. Wow.
And that was a bit distressing.
Wow. You introduce us to some great characters underwater. Everything from the omnipresent slime and that makes the sea and so much else
it's good
work.
Good stuff, slime, yeah.
Right on up to the great octopus, the Einstein among invertebrates, as you describe the octopus.
All octopi are very, 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 very smart. They have an eye. This is identically the same as yours and mine. If you have them in tanks in the lab, they follow you around, you know, when you come in to feed them and so on. They actually look around what you're doing. And off Seattle, I once came into one of the giant octopus, which is, this one was about, I suppose, 10 or 12 feet across. Mm. And as I approached it, it just pumped up two horns out of the top of its head. And it's just to sort of intimidate me.
Hello.
If it was meant to intimidate me, it worked. A mate had told me that, in fact, he'd seen one pull a seagull down from the surface to drown it and then eat it.
You describe it parachuting down onto a
crab
in the open, sort of like just out of the dark.
That's what it does. It's like Count Dracula. And in fact, although it's got a big beak that could crush any crab, what it prefers to do is to drill in through the eye and then dissolve them alive that way. But, I mean, a zoologist in the States once said that, they weren't that dangerous, really. A diver was as likely to be attacked by an octopus as a farmer was by a pumpkin. But I heard of a farmer who actually tripped over a pumpkin, fell into a pond, and drowned. So I don't mess with pumpkins.
You're also great on the sound of the sea and the role that sound plays underwater. You recount, I mean, there's great sort of old sea lore in here as well, but Malaysian fishermen who will simply put their head underwater and listen to their fishing ground to know what's going on there. What?
Well, Cousteau called it the silent world. He must have been deaf, I guess. And I think divers, of course, with the air escaping from their regulator, they're kind of deafened by that. But if you just hold your breath, and particularly at night, you can hear the lisping of the waves on the shore, the rattle of pebbles. And the Malay fishermen do it. They teach their sons. You put your head in the water and you listen for the sounds. If it's like the wind, that's one species of fish. If it's like parched rice, that's another. If it's a voice like a crow, that's a third species. And lots of fish are very noisy. There are some even called croakers. And they're good at drumming, humming, hissing, whistling, purring, popping, snorting, squawking, creaking, and, of course, croaking. And we were listening to whales singing before. Mm. Whales actually have dialects for their district. They have a district dialect.
A brogue here and there.
Yeah, that's right. And a stranger came to Northern Shores in Australia quite recently. And within about 9 months, all the locals were speaking his dialect.
The local whales picked it up. They didn't...
That's right. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Obviously, it sounded good to him. So they all. But the trouble is, of course, the sea's getting noisier for all these animals. With high-powered sonars and so on. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite traumatic. That's one of the problems. And I think even the American Navy have now admitted that a probable cause of some whales being killed was their new sonars. Mm-hmm.
Dolphins and killer whales using sonar, their own natural, to detect the direction and distance of prey. Whales shutting off their sonar to listen for splashing and breathing of very distant creatures. I can imagine the impact that a Navy destroyer makes in that listening pattern. Mm.
Yeah, they can do that. They do. They switch off just to listen. Because they can often... Go on.
Yeah, just that a lot of listeners want to join our conversation. I want to invite them in, if I may. We've got Matt calling from Wilton, New Hampshire. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Very well. What do you know, Matt?
I'm in Wilton, New Hampshire, building a stone wall right now, but I just wanted to share some experiences with the ocean that you called.
Yes, please.
Calling about. I'm an avid spear fisherman and have been for the last 12 years or so, and I also like to boogie board and surf with a lot of my friends. And
where do you do it, Matt? Where?
Primarily in Marshfield, Massachusetts, on the South Shore, which is like 30 miles south of Boston.
Right, okay.
And it's fantastic. So I usually surf on the days when it's, you know, turbulent because you can't have any visibility underwater. And when there's no waves, the water's clear, so we go snorkeling, just freediving, no tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And I spearfish for flounder and tautog and the occasional large lobster that we find. And it's just fantastic what you see under there. You come across schools of herring and schools of stripers, and, you know, sometimes you'll see a seal off in the distance when you're surfing. It's just an adventure that, you know, if I had to pay for it, I probably would.
It sounds like an important part of your life, and there it is. You can just wade in with the snorkel, and you're off. Matt, thanks very much for that picture. Trevor Norton, I wonder how you look at fishermen from your experience as a marine biologist, at fishermen, at spear fishermen, at the whole sportsman's interaction with the sea. Are you part of that? How do you see it?
No, I've never been part of that. Although we do interact at my lab a lot with the local fishing fleet.
Mm-hmm.
We actually do a great deal of work with the government on that. The trouble is with fishing, it's not so much spear fishing. It's commercial fishing that's the problem, of course. Really, fishing is often just a euphemism for overfishing. Almost all the fisheries in the world are overfished. And, you know, in some fisheries, the nets are huge. You can have nets that you could... three or four jumbo jets could fly in formation without touching the sides. Mm. There's nets that could encircle your local cathedral quite easily. And the drift nets that were used to be very common in the Pacific, if you'd put them end to end, they're like a sort of wall of netting that just traps everything and swims through them. And if you put them end to end, one night's deployment of nets, it would have stretched from San Francisco to the Antarctic.
Wow.
That's the problem.
What about the sense of belonging, of wonderment and oneness that Matt describes there, and you describe again and again through the book?
Yeah.
I mean, we are terrestrial creatures. We're born on land. We breathe the air. We're not with gills once we're out of the womb. What about human relationship to the sea? Is there more to find there, or are we always the alien in the sea?
Well, I just find the sea is very seductive, and it's a vast aquarium. It's a sort of living laboratory for me, but it's a cemetery for lost ships. It's a repository of legends. There's something for everyone to obsess about, whether you're a pirate or a poet. And so I think there's always, if you get the taste of the sea, whatever you do, whether it's fishing or diving or whatever, if you once get a taste for the sea, it can last a lifetime.
Rich is calling from Chelsea, Massachusetts. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment about the fall off in sea life. I was did a significant amount of scuba and snorkel in Hawaii in 91.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back this past spring, and the fall off was just phenomenal. I mean, the best places this spring were like average or below average in 91.
What islands were you off of, and how far from the shore were these coral reefs? Or
reefs, and some of the dives were I'd say maybe 100 yards offshore, and some were right onshore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in, we did Kauai, Hawaii, Maui.
And what was missing as you looked out with the mental image of your memory in mind?
The quantity and variety of fish and coral. And particularly the fish was noticeable because of the bright colors, obviously, but it was just almost unbelievable, the difference.
So you went to see the kaleidoscope again, and it was a little spotty. Trevor, you must have had this experience again and again yourself.
Yeah.
You describe
it
in the book. Let's hear it.
Well, when I first went diving 50 years ago, I was kind of sure almost wherever I dived, I was probably the first person to see that underwater landscape. But now, of course, there's nowhere where there isn't a boat every half an hour taking tourists and divers out to the reef or the wreck, whatever it is. It's just the quantity of people. You know, the United States had a very sad experience with this. In 1960, it opened its first underwater park in Key Largo. And it was said to be a national treasure that would be preserved for future generations.
On the way down to Key West, off Florida.
Yep, that's right. And within 30 years, it was devastated. It had 2 million visitors a year. And if you get that many visitors, it simply can't take the, you know, the pressure. When I first went diving at Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt on the Sinai, it is one of the most wonderful. It's a vertical cliff of coral, one of the most wonderful sites in the world. And when I went there, there were two hotels in the 1980s. And now there are 40 huge international hotels, 27 dive centres, and the pressure on the popular sites is enormous. And when you look at the popular sites and do a survey compared to less popular sites, you find that there's about 10 times more coral that's been broken and two or three times more coral that's dead. It's just, there's too many of us doing too much.
So here you are exciting our imaginations toward the sea and luring us down to those very grounds. I mean, are you, maybe you should just, you know, burn the books and shut up about it and let it be.
Well, I just felt I had to tell them people what it was like. As much as what it is like now. And the book is also a warning. It's not just it's just not just an elegy about the sea. It is a warning. But you see, one would encourage people, I want people to go and see the sea and so on. It's just that we all go to the same places and we go in such numbers. I read just recently that 10 million people last year went whale watching and dolphin watching. 10 million people. Now, a whale needs that amount of attention like it needs a hole in the head. Well, it's got a hole in the head, of course, so it's got the worst of both. But, and we do know that even having boats, say, in the vicinity of dolphins, the dolphins' behavior changes entirely.
But are we just toying with the edges here? Is the sea vast enough that all that human attention is dwarfed by the vastness of the oceans, or is it concentrated in places so important that it has a real impact?
No, it has a real impact. It's like everything else. You know, a tourist resort. If everyone goes to the same resort, the resort expands and expands and expands and gets less and less like the place that people wanted to go to in the first place. And I think it's the same in nature. The more we go to these places in huge numbers, that's the problem, the more they're going to suffer.
Beatrice is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Beatrice. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having my call.
Wonderful to have you.
I'm really enjoying this program because although I've done other things for a living, diving is my passion. And I'm an old lady dive master and have helped people learn about how fantastic it is under the water.
And what have you seen? What should we know from your years, Beatrice?
Well, I think I'd like to tell you about an octopus experience because they really are the terrific creatures. I heard Oliver Sacks once say that he didn't think animals had souls except possibly the octopus, he said. Anyway, I was diving with a friend and we saw a little motion over by a dark, cavey-looking place. We went over and there was an octopus in the mouth of the cave very carefully eating a crab bit by bit by bit.
Yes.
And so we stayed to watch. And I had one finger down on the rock below to just balance myself so I could stay still and not make a commotion.
Yeah.
Suddenly I felt something on the back of that hand and looked down and it was another octopus crawling over my hand. I don't know why I didn't grab my hand away, but I didn't. I just stayed still. This octopus made his way to the first one and proceeded to mate with her, which they do by using a special tentacle that has the sperm in it, and they reach under the lady and put the sperm in there.
Under the octopus skirts, as Trevor Norton described it. And you witnessed this at firsthand.
And the female octopus just went right on eating her crab. She didn't even look at him.
Women.
Trevor, have you seen the same Trevor Norton? Have you seen this moment?
Yes, I have. Yes. Oh, it's true. The one I saw, the female octopus seemed to go into a trance, really. Very odd.
Maybe she really liked it, but she appeared to enjoy the crab more.
That's great.
At least he brought her something.
Yes, indeed. Beatrice, we love your tale, and we hope you keep right on diving, and we thank you for calling. Thanks so much for being with us. Let me get a call from Alan in Stoughton, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. Very nice talking to you.
Good to have you.
I have an experience that goes back quite a ways. I was in the Navy during World War II, and I was stationed in Kwajalein in the Marshall Islands.
Sure, way out there.
This is March of 1946. Mm-hmm. One of my friends had a scuba mask. There was no snorkel or anything. We just had to hold our breath when we dove there. And the thing that impressed me the most was the clarity of the water. It was impossible to tell how deep it was. We tried to cool off some beer we had by throwing it overboard, which was pretty impossible in the warm water that was there.
Yeah.
But when I dove down to retrieve it, I realized it was pretty near the limit of my depth.
It was the bottom may have been clear, but much deeper than you thought.
That's right. Wow. Another thing, I tried spearfishing. I made a rig out of a welding rod and a tubing and rubber bands.
Yeah.
And the first fish I hit with it, I guess it wasn't powerful enough. It hit the fish, and the fish may have been about a foot and a half long. The spear bounced off the fish, and I decided it wasn't such a good idea because we were told we couldn't eat the fish anyhow because we wouldn't know which ones were poisonous.
Right, right. But you need a little sharper implement there. But what a world from the 1940s in Kwajalein Atoll. That's terrific in the Marshall Islands. Let's get a call from Geneva, Switzerland. Herman's on the line. Hi, Herman. You're on the air.
Actually, I'm in Switzerland right now, but I'm from the Boston area.
Wonderful to have you. What do you know?
To Mr. Norton, in the early 50s, I lived in Germany, and my father was very interested in diving and got us sort of into it. And a family friend of ours, Klaus Wissel, was part of the Hans Hass team. And I know that he actually died in a diving accident. I believe it was using this technique of filtering the carbon dioxide out of the air. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether you know something about this.
Trevor Norton?
No, I think he did. There was a death. I think that's right. And the trouble is, it's very dangerous. When you breathe oxygen under pressure, oxygen is the gas that keeps us alive. It makes life on the planet possible, but under pressure it's poisonous, and it can give you sudden unexpected spasms and you can pass out and so on. And I think that's what happened. But Hans Hass is still alive, and damn him, he's still handsome.
There it is. Herman.
Yeah.
Herman.
And he's still married to Lottie.
Oh, luscious Lottie, as you've got it. Herman, thanks very much for your call. Trevor Norton, I wish you'd tell us the story of one of your very early heroes in this business, Ed Ricketts. This takes us back to California, but Ed Ricketts, quite a figure, intersects with Cannery Row and John Steinbeck and a whole era. Paint in a bit of that picture for us.
Well, he wasn't. I'd never met Ed Ricketts before my time, but in the 1920s, he was kind of a bit of a layabout, really. He opened a sort of biological supply company of his own at Monterey. You'd send out specimens to schools and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a terrible businessman, but he loved animals. In his catalogue, I remember he said, delightful and beautiful hagfish. Now, hagfish are the most repellent things on the planet. They are really ugly. Yep. You put them in a bucket of water and it's immediately solid slime. And he once climbed inside a very decomposed shark to get a sample of its liver.
Oh.
And he used to test how stingy a sea anemone or a medusa was by just passing it across his lips. Once he couldn't speak for about a week afterward because his lips swelled up.
You read his early books, or his books, and then he became, in the character of Doc, a character in John Steinbeck's 1945 Cannery Row, as you describe it, describing the hobos and hookers of Monterey at that time, and
That's
the lecherous
right.
but lovable marine biologist Doc. There he was, right in the front of Steinbeck's big story.
Well, I don't think Steinbeck made anything up in that story. Mm. It was just he wrote it down like a notebook, and so that's what Ricketts did. I mean, he was quite a character. He would have parties that would last for days and days and days, and he'd play Bach and Scarlatti to his friends, who were mostly sort of philosophers and layabouts, and they drank the cheapest hoots they could get, which they called old tennis shoes. I think that was worse than actually rubbing the medusa again your lips.
Yeah, I guess so.
And there's a very strange story, which was true, which Steinbeck made into a short story, but no one would believe it, in which he had a customer came one day, and she wanted to buy a rattlesnake, but not to take it away, to leave it with Ed, and she would pay for the food. But she insisted on seeing it being fed. And while the rattlesnake swallowed the rat, so did she. She was sort of almost simulating the swallowing of the rat. Fortunately, she only came once. She supported the rattlesnake for some while, but she only came once to see it. Very strange.
Very strange indeed.
There's some very strange people in California.
Yeah, but we love them. I guess that the thing that left me wondering was the whole kind of caution, whether you see a cautionary tale. I mean, Steinbeck wrote Cannery Row, what came out in 1945, capturing the essence of the place, as you say. But within 3 years, the giant sardine cannery business there was closed. Yep. The sardine had gone away. 1952, all closed down. Do we risk that kind of, I mean, that was hard for Californians to imagine that could ever happen, and then suddenly it had happened. It was done. And I couldn't help wondering, as I read you describing that, if we risk something like that on the seas at large. We think of them as realms of abundance. We see signs of decline. Is it possible that one day you put on the mask and what you expect just won't be there?
Yeah, well, I think there's some truth in that. I mean, certainly the big cod fishery from the Grand Banks off Canada, that's completely flopped now. There's nothing there. They just don't catch cod there. And it's always a problem. The trouble is, it's not just the fish that... It's not a biological problem only this. It's not just the fish that are going to be under stress. The endangered species is the fishermen, because this is a social problem as well as a biological problem. And fishermen all over the world are far less numerous and going out of business. And it's simply because of overfishing and poor management. But there are possibilities to get around this. I mean, all over the world, people are putting up sort of protected no-fishing areas. Mm. And the idea isn't just to keep the fishermen out for the sake of keeping them out. It can only really be done successfully if it's done in collaboration and with the agreement of fishermen, because it's their livelihoods that are at stake.
The majority of the world, you remind us, gets its protein from the sea. What about fish farming? Yeah. You describe how China, what was it, a few years back, somebody took 26 scallops to China. Only 26 survived in 1982. Right. And now, off those 26 scallops, China every year produces millions of tons from their descendants. Right. Fish farming, how do you look at that?
Well, no, that seems fine to me. It depends on the conditions of the farming, because in Scotland there's lots of salmon farming, and it's not good for the sea lochs there. It's too intensive, and the food accumulates, there are disease problems and so on, although the product is by and large very, very good. But the scale of sea farming in the East, in Japan in particular, but also in China, is colossal. And it's all down to a guy who was trained at Scripps. Mm. A chap called Seng came to Scripps in about 1950, got his
California.
PhD.
Yep.
Yeah, he worked at the university and did some work in the marine laboratory, and he took all his expertise back to China, and he was the father of all the Chinese aquaculture industry. That's what he came to do. He wasn't doing it surreptitiously.
And now there it is, so vast in its scale.
Yeah, and in a way, it takes the pressure off the sea. If you can actually cultivate this, they are cultivated in the sea, but nonetheless, it takes the pressure off the wild places. Mm. And that's good, because nature thrives on neglect. And you're quite right what you said before, even as a writer, let alone as a diver, you can encourage people to do things that have the poor effects. See, even during the war, the Second World War, when my colleagues went away, they were in the army and navy and so on. Mm-hmm. When they came back at the end of the war, they were astonished how rich the shores were.
A little neglect, boom, back it came.
Because they hadn't been collecting and showing the specimens to students and so on, on the scale when they were away. So marine biologists have to answer as well.
Ian's calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Ian, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom, Trevor. I appreciate the show. Excellent job.
Oh, good.
I've been running a program, actually just finished last year, that was called the Voyage of the Odyssey. And we spent 5.5 years going around the world collecting baseline data on concentrations and distribution of not only persistent organic pollutants, but also metals. And we took small biopsy samples from whales. Now, The data hasn't actually been released yet, so I'm giving you a bit of a sort of...
A heads up here, first glimpse, what's the word?
Yeah, well, I guess the word is somewhat expected, but certainly very disappointing. We found levels of metals such as mercury, chromium, people will know from Aaron Brockovich, cadmium, mm-hmm. high levels of metals that you would expect off industrial areas, mm-hmm. off islands just in the middle of the Pacific, in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we went all the way around the world, and say I don't want to let the information out too much before it's published, but really surprising, you know, the middle of nowhere, islands that have no heavy industry, high levels of metals.
And what's the prognosis that you imagine from that, Ian?
Well, I don't know. It is very interesting. We're working with a lab up at the University of Southern Maine called the WISE Lab. And what's interesting there is Dr. WISE actually exposes cell lines to levels of metals. So you can actually look at the effects that these levels have at a cellular level. So you're looking at DNA damage and also cell death. And the prognosis is not good because the whole body effects on these animals are at this point in time, it's actually too early to say. But it's certainly surprising the concentrations that we found, even when you compare it to sort of levels of pollutants that we find in human female breast tissue.
Even in what we would think of as the middle of nowhere. Ian, thank you for your call. Trevor Norton, That must hurt your ears to hear.
Yeah, that's astonishing, really, especially these sorts of things. I mean, chromium and cadmium, these are very poisonous things. And to be long way... The trouble is, that's why we put stuff in the sea, because the sea disperses it and gets it away from us, you know. Mm. It dilutes everything and disperses it. But it doesn't matter what the concentration is in the sea. All animals, including ourselves, if with our food and with our water we take in, we concentrate things like metals in our bodies. So it builds up over time. It doesn't mean there's a high concentration in the water, but there must be, you know, some in the water to get into the body. It depends, of course, how much these animals travel. They can travel a long way. So we don't know where they got this contamination. But it is worrying. I mean, I can tell you the opposite story.
Please.
You know, about 200 years ago, the Isle of Man was a center for metal mining,
mm-hmm.
mostly copper, and there was some cadmium, other things, and some lead. And the levels of these things in the creatures around the Isle of Man are low, very low. So it's quite the opposite story. And it shows you the problem with pollution. It doesn't necessarily stay where you put it, especially if you put it in the ocean. It can go anywhere.
What's your big long-term prognosis? Are you optimistic that as we understand marine biology better, our interaction with the seas will lead to maybe a little of that neglect and flourishing that you described, or is the human footprint going to splash it, you know, to its doom?
Well, there are now forces that are getting almost beyond our control that we've set in motion. For example, all over the world, corals are starting to bleach. Now, corals are very interesting. They are actually a partnership between the coral and some microscopic algae. And the algae sort of photosynthesize like mad, and it's utilized by the coral. The corals have got a very narrow temperature range. They like the water warm, but not too warm.
Mm.
If it warms up, they dump the algae, and they go white. And that's happening everywhere.
Well, it makes us all the more grateful for the moment that you caught, and hope that we use that insight, that understanding, that clear love for the sea, to throw some kind of blanket of protection around it. Trevor Norton, we're grateful to you for your time and for the book, Underwater, to Get Out of the Rain. Thank you very much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Trevor Norton joined us from the Isle of Man. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.